This morning, we are addressing a story that is known by believers and non-believers alike. A story that is known by Christians and non-Christians alike. Whether the story is known in depth or in principle, everyone knows the story of David and Goliath. In fact, we're entering into college basketball season. And every time that one of the traditional power programs plays a smaller program, a powerful team plays a smaller team, they say it's a matchup of David and Goliath. That this is a story that in this culture, everyone knows. Today, we're going to talk about the courage that it took for David to stand up and for David to stand up against the larger Goliath. This is week four of our series called Matters of the Heart. And we're here talking about the life of David overall. So the story here of David and Goliath begins at the Valley of Elah. And the Valley of Elah was culturally a big deal because it could also be called the Valley of Death. Elah was this massive valley where many, many battles took place, many bloody battles, and many lives were lost in the Valley of Elah. And what would happen here is the Philistines are facing the Israelites, and both sides would camp out on the slope leading into the valley. So you'd have on this side the Philistines camping out on the slope. On this side, you would have the Israelites, and ultimately then they would meet in battle in this large valley. And this happened time after time after time again. The Israelites and the Philistines facing off. But who are the Philistines? Who are these that we hear about in the Bible? If you read the Bible, if you've been in church very long at all, you hear about the Philistines. You hear about Goliath and his army that was there. So who are they? First of all, they're a seafaring people. And they would go and they would attack different cultures and different cities and different kingdoms. They would attack them and they would strike fear in all of the victims that they heard were, that the Philistines were coming. In fact, they were much like the Vikings of old. If you're not familiar with biblical history, then maybe the comparison made in European history where the Vikings were seafaring people and they would go to another land and they would attack and they would pillage and they would cause havoc. That would be comparable with the Philistines. Now, also the Philistines, that we need to understand that these battles between Israel and between the Philistines were far more than physical wars. They were very spiritual battles. You see, the Philistines had idols that they served, and the Israelites had Yahweh. And then within Israel was the seed of the woman that would produce the Messiah who would ultimately crush the enemy. And so the Messiah then would bring about the church, and through the church, God would accomplish his purposes and fulfill his will on earth. So the spiritual battle was this, that if you get rid of Israel, you get rid of the seed. When you get rid of the seed, you get rid of the Messiah. You get rid of the Messiah, you get rid of God's plans. Therefore, it was a very spiritual battle between false gods and the one true God. Very spiritual battles. So the Philistines served a god named Dagon. Dagon was half fish, half man, and he was an evil, perverse god. And he was coming against Yahweh. And it reminds me of the verse in Ephesians chapter 6 where it says that we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers that set themselves up against God. And the Philistines, if we want to know who they are, were also tall people relationally to culture in that part of the world. And among them were some very large people as well. And as we read the story about the Philistines, and as we read the story about David and Goliath, and as we read the story, we say, hey, we don't have people like that today. We can't really capture that today. We don't really get that. Well, really, have you watched the NBA? Some tall, tall people in the NBA. And among the Philistines, again, were some very large people. And some say that these large people were descendants of the original inhabitants of Canaan when the Israelites were coming out of slavery, coming into the promised land, and that they came into Canaan and they said, they're like giants. We're like grasshoppers in their sight. And so some say they were the descendants of Canaan. They may have had some giantism in their genes, and they were tall. And not only were they tall, but they were very wide people. In fact, a Greek scholar by the name of Robert Affer, he says that Goliath was at least 8 feet tall. Most other scholars say this, is that Goliath was over 9 feet tall. And so many people at that point say, there's no way. It's just not possible. I mean, that's too huge. We can't even relate to that now, and nutrition's better, care's better, and so there's no way it was the case back then. But really, even in America, we have the tallest recorded man in modern history. In fact, if you look at Robert Wadlow, that he was 8 feet, 11 inches tall, and he was 492 pounds. So let me put it this way. Shaquille O'Neal is 7 feet, 320 pounds, and this guy made Shaquille O'Neal look like a midget. 8 feet 11. 492 pounds. There's a picture of the tallest man in the world. And the story tells us, and what we learn from history, is that Goliath was even bigger than that. And he inspired fear. He had this powerful presence about him. And if you look at Goliath, and if you look at his story, that we need to understand that we face situations in our lives that feel like giants to us. We come across moments that in our lives that they seem giant, they seem huge to us, they intimidate us, and we lose hope because we see how big our situation seems in relationship to us. It intimidates us. And that's how the Philistines did battle, through intimidation. See, not only were the Philistines tall, but they also wore helmets that stood up higher on their heads to make them appear even taller. And then not only that, Greg, they would then wear these bright feathers on top of that so it would extend the appearance of their height. And then they would wear this bronze armor, which in that day was significant because of the ability or lack of ability of cultures and other cultures to do metal works. And they would wear this bronze armor. And then they would have these iron swords. And here's the amazing thing is that Israel, in that day, in all the country, they had two iron swords. Yet the Philistines, everyone had an iron sword. And so it was significant in the day. And so then what they would do is that with the bronze armor, they would stand in the sun and reflect it to the enemy. And they would bang their drums and then they would chant and they would stomp and they would make noise all together. And it was incredibly intimidating. Plus, they had giants. So they've got all this going on, plus a giant. And here's, they would lead through intimidation. In fact, Goliath's armor alone was 125 pounds. And then he would have an armor bearer that walked with a huge shield in front of him. So you have Goliath way up here. Then you have the armor bearer walking in front of him. So the only thing exposed was just a small part of his forehead. It was incredibly intimidating. And so today, maybe you have challenges in your life that you feel are like that. That it's giant, that it's strong, that it's armored, that it's got a shield bearer in front of him, and you're saying, the only thing I see is this right here and this sheer force coming at me, and we feel like that, and it feels huge and overpowering and intimidating, and it causes fear in our hearts. And the truth is, we all have fears. We all have fears, and each of our fears is different, but we all face them in our lives. I mean, we're human. And maybe for some, it's the war hero who did amazing things in battle, but comes home and doesn't have the courage to deal with family, to deal with the challenges there. Or maybe it's someone who's a high-powered on their job and successful in their job, but they don't know how to have the courage to raise their children. That all of us have fears. And today, what's your greatest fear? If we were to ask you, what is the greatest fear in your life, and you were to lay everything bare with nothing held back and just present it out, we'd be honest with yourself or honest with God, what is our greatest fear? Maybe it's the fear of dying. Maybe it's the fear of a loss of reputation. Maybe it is the fear of the loss of security. Or maybe it's the fear of losing a family member that's so dear to us, and it can be terrifying and intimidating, and we just don't know how to handle it. And again, there's nothing wrong with fear per se. It's very normal human reaction. And courage, though, is not the lack of fear, but rather courage is facing your fear and doing the right thing anyway. In fact, maybe we can go back to the Wild West days with John Wayne. Well, he wasn't really in the Wild West, but we'll take it in his movies. But John Wayne said it this way: fear is being scared to death, but saddling up anyway. Or courage. Did I say fear? Let's rewind that just a little bit. Courage is being scared to death, but saddling up anyway. There we go. That's it right there. And everybody said, all right. And Israel's greatest fear was standing right in front of them. The Philistine army, with probably superior technology for the day, with probably larger individuals as a whole, and then a giant champion fighter calling them out moment by moment by moment. So what can we learn from the battles that the Israelites faced? David's battle with Goliath. Number one is that life's challenges can be intimidating. That if we're honest, the things that we go through in life, the challenges that we face, the trials that we go through, that they can be incredibly intimidating in our lives. And here's what we see is that it says in verses really 4-9, but I want to read verse 8 here, is that Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." So we see here that that Goliath challenges the children of Israel to representative battle. He says, "I'm the champion. You send your champion. We'll fight one-on-one, and whoever wins, that nation wins. Whoever loses, that nation loses." And so the thing is, we feel like, man, that's odd. We can't relate to anything like that. That's totally different than how we do battle today. We don't have anything like that. When the truth is, we do have something exactly like it, and it's called spectator sports. That when we go home and we watch the Cowboys, that we're going, "Man, come on, we won today. In fact, the Cowboys have won 5 Super Bowls," and we say, "We won 5 Super Bowls." Oh, wait, what's that? 5 Super Bowl rings, and the Giant fans only have 4. Oh, I didn't mean for that to come up, guys. And any Eagles fans, look at your pop rings. I didn't mean for that. I'm so sorry, guys. I didn't mean to detract from the message here. That we've won 5 Super Bowls. You know, that's exactly what we do. And we didn't do anything besides sit on the couch and eat chips and maybe yell a little bit. So representative battle, that's basically how it was, is that Goliath proposed, "You send your champion, I'm the champion, we'll do battle. The winner, that nation wins. The loser, that nation loses." Now, we don't know if Israel actually accepted that challenge because of the battle that ensued after David and Goliath, but that was the challenge laid out. In Israel, that was their greatest fear, and they were completely afraid. And at this point, this is significant, so remember this. At this point, Israel is away from God, that they're not serving Yahweh. You see, Saul and his moody, insecure leadership has allowed Israel to drift away from God. Because you see, if they had been following God, if they had been pursuing the Lord, if they had continued in covenant with God, if they had continued in this following the Lord, they would have known how to do battle. Because in Deuteronomy chapter 20, there was a specific process laid out for the people of Israel on how to do battle. What they would do when it was time for battle, that they would come and they would gather all the army together, all the men together of fighting age. And all the men would come together of fighting age, and they would stand before them, and they would say this: "The battle belongs to the Lord." They would make this proclamation that God is our king and that we will follow him and the battle belongs to the Lord. And then the officer would stand up and he would say, "Is anyone in here newly married?" And those who were newly married would raise their hand and he would say, "Okay, you go home. Take care of the marriage vows. Take care of that wedding covenant." And then he would say, "Has anyone in here built a home? Have you built a home recently?" And those who built a home, a new home, they would raise their hands and he'd say, "Go home. Tend to your house. Get it in order." And then he would say, "Has anyone in here planted a vineyard?" And then those who had planted a vineyard would raise their hand and he would say, "Go home. The vineyard needs to be tended. It needs to be mature before you can leave it. Go home." And then those who hadn't planted a vineyard or built a home or weren't newly married, they were like, "Oh man, I wish I'd just gotten married. Oh man, I wish I'd just planted a vineyard. Oh, if I'd have just built that house, my wife was right. Oh." And then he would say, "Is anyone here afraid? Has anyone in here ever been afraid?" He would say, "Go home. If you're afraid, go home." And then God would whittle down the army so that it would be lower than they thought it should be and lower than they thought it could be for victory, but so that God would get the victory and God would get the glory and God would get the praise and not man. But they weren't following God. And so they had forgotten how the battle should go. And so now being taunted, they live in fear. And instead of allowing the army to whittle down, they're staying there just trying to hold the fort, hoping something will happen to Goliath. But what they had forgotten, that one man with God can change history. One man with God who's fully committed to the Lord and who's following him with everything inside. One person can change history because it's a spiritual battle. But with the Israelites, there was no one who would step up with faith over fear. So Goliath is taunting them twice a day for 41 days. So twice a day, the Israelites hear Goliath get up and he taunts them and he taunts their God. And I want to tell you this, that's how fear works. When we don't confront the issues in our life and we don't confront the fears in our hearts and we don't confront the things we're dealing with, that ultimately it's with us when we wake up in the morning and we're thinking on it and we're worried about it and we're stressed by it. And then when it's time to go to bed at night, that thing is on our minds and we can't sleep, or we wake up early that we don't get full rest. And in those things that we don't confront in our life, that ultimately when we're with our family, we can't really engage with our family. And when we're with the job, we can't really engage on our job, that we've got these things that we're dealing with, that when we don't address the giants in our life, that's how fear works. But God is waiting for you and you and me and us for a person to stand up and claim the promises of God for our lives. And no one for Israel did. They were paralyzed. And because no one stood, God is mocked. But then along comes this young David. He's young. He's not even in the army. In fact, did you know the only reason that David is there is that he was out tending sheep? His dad calls him in and says, "Son, take this bread and this cheese to your brothers." Bread and cheese. So basically, he's an ancient day pizza delivery boy. Right? Come on, get in your little Domino's car and go deliver some pizzas to your brothers. And so there's nothing wrong with that, but that's what he was. He wasn't even a soldier. He was a food delivery guy. And he shows up there, and he hears what's going on, and he's amazed. Now, the soldiers have heard it 82 times, and they're numb with fear. But Goliath, he's taunting. And something I want you to capture in that moment is that Goliath used to stand on the hill before the valley. And he would yell across the valley, "Hey, send someone down. I'll meet them there and we'll fight." But by this point, he's no longer on the hill. He is standing in the valley saying, send someone down to me and I'll fight them. That's what fear does. Unconfronted fear in our life, unconfronted giants in our life that they suddenly began to take territory they were never intended to have. That the issues of our life that are not in line with God, that if we don't confront them, they will take territory in our lives that God never intended for it to have inside of us. That it will take the territory of our joy, it will take the territory of our hope, it will take the territory of faith and of peace, that it will rob us of territory that God has designed us to be victorious in. That we will lose areas of our lives that God has designed us to be winners and not captive in. It will consume your energy, your life, your joy with unconfronted giants. And David hears the giant and he's shocked. He's not fearful, he's shocked because he expected Israel to win. See, David's young. He's 17 at the oldest is what we can figure. Some would say he's even as young as 13. But we'll just say 17. That's a good number for us. And he's a small kid, not fully developed, not fully grown. And Goliath is a giant warrior. But David is not comparing himself to the giant. David is comparing the giant to God. And I want to tell you this, when you compare the giant to God, the whole perspective changes. Like when we're comparing our ability to handle an issue to compare to the issue, we can feel intimidated. But when we're saying, greater is he that is within me than he that is in the world, our whole perspective changes when we compare our giant to God. How many of you need to change a perspective? From how you can deal with it to how God can empower you to deal with it, or how God himself can deal with it as we trust him with every issue in life. You see, he wasn't comparing himself, a small shepherd boy, to a giant champion. He was comparing God to the giant, and everything changes in that perspective. And so he's comparing here, and he comes and he says, hey, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that would defy our God? And when he uses the term uncircumcised, he's talking more than a surgery. He's talking about a man that is not in covenant with God. And he's saying, how can this guy who's not in covenant with God defeat us when we are in covenant with God? How can he defy us when greater is he that is in me than he that is in the world? How can he defy our God? How can he defeat us when we are in this relationship with God and he will help us through the battle? You see, we need to change our perspective sometimes and say, hey, I'm in covenant with God. I'm in relationship with God, and I'm going to stand on the promises that God is faithful. How many of you believe that God is faithful? And so he's saying, how can this guy who's not in covenant with God defy our God? You see, David wasn't a deist. A deist is someone who believes that God created it, God set it in motion, God blew it into existence and put it into spinning, and then walks away for us to be in it on our own. He believed that Yahweh was alive, that Yahweh was involved, that he was the living God who would take care of his children, that would protect them, that would lead them. And David was ready to confront the giant that stood across from him. Because I really believe this, that David was full of God, he was full of God's word, that he had had time shepherding and time alone with God, and while he's shepherding, that he was singing worship and writing songs of praise and writing psalms, and that while he is alone with the sheep, he is in covenant and in relationship and in our interaction with God. And let me say this, if you are consumed with God, you will not be consumed with fear. That if you are full of God and full of his presence and full of the Holy Spirit, you will not be full of fear, period. So David gets up to fight in the power of God, because Goliath can't fight God. So we all have fears. It's human nature. It's normal. It's part of life. But how we deal with those fears differs. So if you're taking notes today, number two is people have various methods of confronting challenges. Depending on our personality, depending on our background, depending on our strengths and weaknesses, we all have different methods of confronting fears and challenges. In the Israelites, if you look at this passage, the Israelite army, their method was the method of paralysis. Do nothing and just hope it goes away. In fact, our daughters, from the moment they were born, they were always around people at church. They were always people wanting to hold them, and we brought them to church. Like, we had the baby on a Tuesday, and Tamara was in church Wednesday night at youth service. Crazy, but we did it. And then we had, you know, so when it came time for McKenna, there was this one little girl in the youth group, a junior high girl, who she was just like over the top energetic. Have you ever seen an over the top energetic junior high girl? I have. And there was this one little girl who was always like, oh, let me hold McKenna. Let me hold McKenna. Oh, let me hold. They were like all this. And McKenna, that she would, before holding McKenna, and McKenna would see this girl coming, McKenna would go. She'd act like she was asleep. And she wouldn't let her hold her. And she would act like she was asleep, but she would lean in really hard so that she was stiff towards, and the girl couldn't grab her. And so I would laugh. And so one day, McKenna's running around after youth service on a Wednesday night, and there's several hundred teenagers around. She's running around, and all of a sudden, this girl pops out from the crowd and goes, McKenna, come here. And McKenna goes, awesome. And that was Israel. Goliath going, send someone down to fight me. Their method was paralysis. It says in verse 11 of this passage, on hearing the Philistines' words, Saul the king and all of the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. In fact, psychologists would call this learned helplessness. There's some experiments that some researchers did on dogs, and they would put the dogs in this hammock, and they'd have their legs on the ground to where they couldn't move and get away, and then they had electrified the floor to where they would push a tone, the tone would go off, and then an electrical charge would come into the floor, and the dogs couldn't move. They were with a mild but strong enough shock to cause them pain, and they couldn't get away. And so they learned that that was going to happen. There's nothing that they could do about it. And so this was called the dog tone experiments. And so then what they would then did is took the hammock or the restraining thing off them, sat them on the ground, and built a small wall about 6 inches around them, and then they would shock the floor again, and all the dog had to do was to jump over the little wall, and they wouldn't be shocked, but they felt like there was no way to avoid the pain, and so they would just whimper down, and they would get shocked because they didn't know that they could get over it. It was learned helplessness. Now, I know some of you are totally offended that they would do this experiment on dogs. I mean, I really thought they'd use cats. I mean, that'd be a much better option. What? I'm just kidding. Sort of, there. So what they would do is the dog felt like there was no way to get away from the pain, no way to avoid the shock, and they were so demoralized that they would just whimper down and they would take the pain and live with it. And my fear is this. My fear is that people do the same thing, that we've been so demoralized by that thing in our life, that we've been so intimidated by that giant in our life that we don't even try to confront it anymore. Maybe it's been that habitual sin that you keep falling into and you can't seem to stop the habit, and you're in that habitual sin over and over and over and over, and you just can't stop it. Maybe it's the fear of the future, what's coming. Maybe it's the fear of the unknown. Maybe it's the fear of the known. I know what's happening next, and I just can't deal with that. And we have the fear, and you live in terror, and you live in helplessness, and you live demoralized because of fear. That was Israel, and no one would take a stand. And so Saul does what any good leader would try to do, what any wise king would try to do. He tries to bribe the army. He says, you know what? If you go fight Aaron, that I will give you lots of money. If you'll go and fight, Greg, that I'll let you live tax-free, you and your family in the land forever. All right, back to Aaron, single guy. I will let you marry my daughter. I will give you my daughter. Now, Saul was tall, and the Bible said he was handsome, so his wife, or his daughter, was probably tall and beautiful. And so, the army's like, money, no taxes, a beautiful wife. And so then all of a sudden, Goliath comes out, Wait, that's another giant story. Giant, he comes out and begins to taunt God. And suddenly, the army's like, dead men don't need money. Dead men don't pay taxes. And suddenly, Saul's daughter went from hot to homely in just an instant, bam. And they were afraid. And no one steps up to take the challenge. They were paralyzed by fear except for David. David steps up. So Israel, they dealt with it with paralysis. But his brother, David's very own brother, who was passed over to be king, here's what he says. Eliab's method was being a sideline coward. It says in verse 28 that when Eliab, David's oldest brother, remember the one that was tall and strong and handsome and impressive to the prophet Samuel, but instead God said, I've rejected him because of his heart. He stands up and he burned with anger at David and he asks him, why have you come here? And why did you leave those few little sheep that you tended in the wilderness? I know how conceited you are. I know how wicked your heart is. You've come down here only to watch the battle. He insults him. And you want to know why? Because it's okay to be a coward when everyone else is a coward. But when someone steps up in faith and it reveals your cowardice, you want to insult them to try to save face for what you really are. And so he insults him, trying to bring him down to his level. But what did David do? If you go home and you read this passage today, you go home and read this, it says that David turned from him. He didn't try to argue with him. He didn't try to debate him. He didn't try to defend his character. It says that he turned from him. Because sometimes you learn from your critics, and sometimes you just walk away. Sometimes you defend yourself, but many times you just walk away and you outlast your critics. So David turned and he walked away. And what we see is that Saul should have been the one fighting because he was head and shoulders taller. He was a proven warrior. But yet Saul's method of dealing with a challenge was to be an armchair quarterback. That he was an armchair quarterback, that it says here in verse 33 that, David, you're not able to go out to battle. You're just a young boy. And then in verse 38, it's like, okay, you're going to go to battle. So here, wear my armor and put my helmet on and put these things on, put on my tunic. And so I want to ask, how desperate was it for the king, a proven warrior, to send out a 17-year-old boy who wasn't a proven warrior, who wasn't even in the army, and to say, hey, yeah, go into battle? He told him how to fight, but he was unwilling himself to fight. And David doesn't give in to his brother's insults nor Saul's direction. You ever notice that sometimes people try to tell you how to fight your battles and they won't even deal with their own issues in their lives? That ultimately we need wise counselors, but in the biggest picture, in the most direct way, we need to hear from God. And so it says that David tries on the armor, and in verse 39 it says David tried to walk. That cracks me up. David was a young boy. Saul was the biggest guy in Israel. It just didn't fit. And he was really respectful. He was really nice, but he said this, I haven't tested it. So what he's really saying is, I'm not trusting in your armor. I'm not trusting in your technology. I have tested God, and God is faithful, and I'm going to go with God. That I haven't tried this, but I've tried God, and I'm sticking with God. And for us in our lives, some of us in here today, that we need to say, I've tried everything else, and I've tried God, and I'm sticking with God. I'm not going with man's wisdom. I'm not going with culture's ways. I'm trusting God. How many of you in here that there's areas of your life you need to trust God with instead of trying to do it your own way? That's where David was. He said, it's not tested. He was respectful. It's not tested. In other words, I'm trusting God. in God. So David moves forward. The Israelites did it with paralysis. Saul was an armchair quarterback. His brother was a sideline coward. But then here's the deal. Goliath, his method of dealing with challenges was with self-confidence. In verse 42, it says this. Goliath looked David over, looked him up and down, and he saw that he was little more than a boy. And then it goes on. I think this is funny. Glowing with health and handsome. Why does it even matter? Why does it matter? I've never looked at one of our soldiers, our neighbors, Navy SEALs guys, and go, man, he is glowing with health and handsome. I'm so proud of that. I don't care if he's ugly. Go do battle, brother. It was weird to me. And then it says, and he despised him because of his glowing with health and handsome. He said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his God, by Dagon. He says, come here, and I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals. I want to tell you that this was the best trash talking possible. He's talking smack. He's laying out some trash talk. But I want you to understand that this battle is not the battle of a rookie versus a veteran. This is not a battle of coward or courage, nor a battle of hero versus villain. This is two courageous champions. Goliath, champion of his people. David, who's fought lions and bears. This is two courageous men. But where they got their courage from totally separated them. Goliath got his from self-confidence. And I get it, really, I do. If you think about it, that Goliath, his confidence was high because he was huge versus a small boy glowing with health and handsome. A pretty boy is what he's saying. You're just a pretty boy. That's all you are. You can't fight me. Goliath is covered in brass armor. He has an armor bearer in front of him. He has a weaver's rod that the tip of the rod alone was 15 pounds. He has a giant sword in his hand, and that he is, in the natural, has every reason to be confident. David's a baby. I mean, even his dad, as we talked about a few weeks ago, when he goes to be anointed as king, even his dad was embarrassed of him. He goes, he's just the baby. He's out watching the sheep. Don't you like one of these sons? Don't you like these? David, he's the one that we put off outside because he's not that impressive. Even his dad was embarrassed by him. How many of you in here have ever read anything about birth order? You ever read anything about birth order? And so you've got the oldest characteristics, the middle child or children's characteristics, and the baby characteristics. How many of you in here, you're the first child, you're the firstborn, raise them up high. Well, like, you know what? You expected me to ask you if you were first because first children always go first. First children expect to be first. First children expect to be and want to be the boss. So if you're married to a first child and you didn't know that, you know it now, that they expect to be the boss. In fact, not only that, when we were headed to the moon, the original seven Mercury astronauts, did you know that every one of those seven were a firstborn child? Because they were like, we haven't been to the moon. I'll go to the moon. I'll go to the moon first. I'm supposed to. I'm the oldest child. Look at me. I'm the boss. Well, then there's the middle child. And the middle child, they want to be first as well, but their motivation's different. It's not like, I expect to be the boss, I want to be the boss, I'm supposed to be, I'm the oldest child. Theirs is, I'm going to be better than my brother, I'm going to be better than my sister, I'm going to be on top to prove to them that I'm better than them. Look at me, I'm better than them. And then you've got the baby. You've got the last born. And you know what their mentality is? Feed me. Love me. Look at me. Everybody give me attention. Look at me. Aren't I great? Love me. Change my diaper. Look at me. David had zero expectations on his life. David had no pressure because he was the youngest and the smallest, that there were zero expectations. And Goliath expects to win, but God. And sometimes when we look at life's challenges, we don't expect to win. We think that it's this giant, it's intimidating, it strikes fear, and suddenly we're thinking, how do I get past this? I'll never get past this. I'll just have to live with the pain. There's no way around it. But God. But Goliath had self-confidence. Let me encourage you with this, Grace Hill. Self-confidence leaves you blind to your weaknesses and to others' strengths. Self-confidence at some point will ultimately lead to sloppiness because it comes and breeds arrogance in us. And Goliath, maybe, just maybe, he got sloppy. And as David swung his sling, as he gets it going and he lets it go, that we know that the rock could fly at over 100 miles per hour. And as the rock cut through the air, it came and embedded in the giant's forehead, sinking into his frontal lobe. And he said, "Nothing like that ever entered my mind before." And that he falls dead to the ground. So it was self-confidence, and it leads to sloppiness. But here's the deal. The thing that separated David and Goliath was David's method of dealing with challenges was the God confidence. Now, here's a moralistic story that I think is funny. It's that there's a story of a guy that he died and he went to heaven and he's walking up to the pearly gates and he sees St. Peter there. And when St. Peter gets him, he's looking through his chart. He goes, "I'm looking on your chart and you didn't really do anything bad, but you didn't really do anything good either. So, I mean, is there anything in my charts that I'm missing? I don't know how to reward you. Is there anything in your chart that I'm missing that I need to know?" The guy said, "Well, actually, there is." He said that I drove up to this kind of sketchy neighborhood, and I got out of my car to go meet with someone, and I see across the street this young woman being accosted by this motorcycle gang. And I thought, and she was in fear, and they were starting to surround her. And he said, "I grabbed the tire iron out of the back of my trunk, and I ran across the street, and I ran up to the biggest, most muscled, scariest one of them all, and I reached up to his earring, and I ripped it out of his ear, and I held up my tire iron. I said, 'If you want to get to her, you've got to go through me.'" And Peter goes, "Wow, that's incredible. I mean, I don't see it in my charts. When did that happen?" The guy goes, "Oh, about 2.5 minutes ago." A little delayed reaction there. You see, there's something to being courageous and something to being stupid. And David wasn't being stupid. He had a God confidence, realizing that compared to the giant, God was huge, and compared to God, the giant was small. And it says this in verse 45. David yells back after the giant threw out some great trash talk. David replies back, "You come against me with the sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, who you have defied." He talks back with a godly determination. And we know the story again. Goliath dies. And I think the point that God is making in this moment is this: that we never underestimate what one person can do when they're committed fully to the Lord. What can God do through that one person, that one life that says, "I am going to move forward in the promises of God"? What can God do through one life, maybe even your life today? What can God do through you? And I want you to know this. Dilemma three is how you face your challenges is this. How you face your challenge is contagious. In the second part of verse 51, it says, "When the Philistines saw that their hero Goliath was dead, they turned and they ran." It says, "The men of Israel and Judah, they surged forward with a shout, and they pursued the Philistines to the entrance of Gath and to the gates of Ekron." That both, here's what I want you to capture, both fear and faith are contagious. The fear of Saul as the king and the faith of David to fight Goliath, both fear and faith are contagious. And I want you to understand that you can be a catalyst for others trusting God. I want to say that again. Maybe you need to write that down today. Because you think, "Man, how can God use me?" You can be a catalyst for people trusting in God. Believe in God. Expect to hear from God. When you pray, expect to hear him talk to you. Expect to hear those things. Because I have seen in my life I have seen one person be a catalyst for others, for coworkers. Keith, I've seen them be a catalyst for their family and their extended family trusting in God. I've seen them be a catalyst for friends that they, as they trust God, their faith is a catalyst to others. And maybe they'll never come to our church or your church, but you're a catalyst for them getting right with God and pursuing the Lord. And maybe they go to the church down the street, but you're a catalyst for them growing in God, because the wind's here for Grace Hill, people knowing God and growing in God. Salvation and life transformation, those are the winds, and you can be a catalyst for that in people's lives. So in closing today, here's what I want you to know, that we've seen here both fear and faith. Both coward and courage. The question is, what will your courage be based on? Self-courage or God courage? Because we live in times, we live in days to where it can be incredibly intimidating. As we look at now and we look at our situation, or maybe we look at our future and how are we going to fund that, or how are we going to live, that we could be incredibly fearful about life. But God's looking for a person, or God is looking for a group of people who will not be intimidated by trials, who will not be intimidated by troubles, who will not be intimidated by fear, who will not be intimidated by culture, but who will move forward and take courage in Him. Not in your ability to handle it, but in God's ability to empower you. Let's be the people who trust God no matter what. Guys, let that be what characterizes us, that we are going to turn to God and trust God in every moment. So how do we take courage? How do we take courage? Do we look to the heroes of the faith that are in Hebrews 11? If you read the Bible says to remember them, but we don't look to them, because in the very next chapter, Hebrews 12, it says that we look unto God, who's the author of our faith. That's who we look to. We look to Jesus. And so how did Jesus keep his courage in intimidating circumstances? Because we think of him sometimes right now as just as God in heaven. But he came to earth. He faced persecution, rejection. He faced the cross. They faced just terrible moments. So how did he keep his joy? How did he keep his courage? That he did it through joy that was set before him. The hope that was set before him. Now what's that hope? It was the joy that gave him courage. It was the joy that kept him going. And if you're really full of joy, you won't be full of fear. But what was it? And I want to say this, it was you. What was the joy? It was you. What was the reason that he could face rejection? You. What was the reason that he could face the Garden of Gethsemane? You. What was the reason that he could face the death on the cross? You. The hope and the joy of seeing you redeemed because of his sacrifice and to see you in heaven, that you were the thing that kept him going, the joy set before him. So how do we do it? Ultimately, he is our joy. That we can face troubles, we can face the giants, we can endure it, we can have courage because of him. Because we don't look right now at the here and now, we look to all eternity. And we can be courageous because of him. Let me ask you again, what's your greatest fear? What is the greatest giant that you have to face? What's that greatest fear? Maybe it's this. Maybe it's the loss of reputation. Understand this, that Jesus gave up his reputation for you. Maybe it's the fear of rejection. The Bible says that Jesus was completely rejected and abandoned by his disciples, by the Jewish people, even by God on the cross, so that you and I could be accepted for all eternity. Maybe your greatest fear is suffering pain. Jesus suffered pain on the cross, ultimately, so that we could get a resurrected body in heaven and live in eternity in incredible peace and joy. Maybe your greatest fear is finances and being able to live and to be comfortable. Jesus died, or Jesus became poor, so ultimately we could receive his glory. Maybe that your greatest fear is death and the fear of dying or someone around you dying, but ultimately Jesus died on the cross so that we could have the Death has lost its sting. Death has lost its victory, so that ultimately for us to be absent from this body is to be in the presence of the Lord when we're in relationship with Him. Guys, we have nothing to fear. I want to say that again. I want you to capture that. You and I, as believers, as followers of Jesus Christ, we have nothing to fear. And for the believer, that we have great things to look forward to in eternity, we have nothing to fear because the best is yet to come. The best is yet to come. So for Christians, believe this, that one day that the giant you're facing will be all but forgotten as you continue to trust in God. Put your faith in Him. And be courageous. Would you stand with me today? I want us to pray together. Would you bow your head just for a moment? And I want us to pray. With heads bowed, eyes closed, in just a moment, we're going to pray just for courage in our lives. And maybe there's an area that you're dealing with a giant that you can't seem to defeat. And we want to pray with you in the prayer room right to the side here. We have several of our men that are there. We want to pray with you. Maybe it's habitual sin. Maybe it's a situation that causes you great stress and fear and worry. God wants to give you courage because greater is He that is in you than He's in the world. So let me pray for us. Father, today, You see every man and woman in this room. You see their lives and You see where they're at. You see giants that they're facing, and maybe some aren't facing them now, but they will soon, one day. And so, Lord, that they would be prepared. But Lord, for those who are facing giants right now, God, I pray that You would give them strength and give them courage because of who You are, not because of what the giant is, because of who You are and not because of the circumstance. So today, Lord Jesus, let Your will be done and give us courage to move forward. Guys, have an amazing week in the Lord. And if you're facing a giant, I encourage you today, trust God, because God is bigger than any circumstance that you are facing, and He is tested and faithful.